I'm Brian McCreath at Symphony Hall with Tony Fogg, the artistic administrator and director of Tanglewood for the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Tony, the 2019-2020 season is just announced, and as always, there's just way too much stuff to talk about that we won't even get to, but I want to talk about a lot of the really important things about the season and sort of those pillars that define what that season is going to be like. So thanks for taking a few minutes to talk with me. I appreciate it. A
pleasure as always, Brian.
Andres is here, as I seem to put it together, for basically half the season, he's on the podium. And I guess one of the questions I have, we'll get into the details of some of those programs, but where does that stand right now with the basic practice of orchestras of this stature and the presence of their music directors? Is that about what most orchestras have with their music directors, or is it a little different?
Well, bear in mind that Andres also gives us about 4 or 5 weeks in the summer.
Yeah.
And so when you add all of that up, and occasionally, as we did last summer, we tag on another 2.5 weeks of touring in Europe, I think it's probably more than most of the major music directors are giving to their orchestras, at least in the U.S. And so we're extremely lucky to have this this amount of time with our music director. And of course, it means that we can cover a great range of repertoire. We can undertake some wonderful recording projects, some touring, some commissions, and so on. So with that number of weeks, it is possible to shape the season in a way which wouldn't otherwise be possible if we just had, you know, 8 weeks, as some orchestras have with their music directors.
Yeah. And one thing that I think that maybe some in the public, and I certainly wonder myself sometimes, is how much, when you're working on formation of a season, how much is Andres involved in that discussion? Obviously, quite a bit, but in terms of the overall shape of the season, even for the weeks that he's not here, how does that discussion work for the two of you?
Yes, that's a good question. He's quite involved, but ultimately, I'm sort of the person on the spot when it comes to having the one-on-one conversations with the guest conductors, but it's always informed by something that Andres and I have talked about beforehand, or the selection of guest conductors is something that, you know, we talk through, and he doesn't necessarily need to sign off on it, but he certainly wants to be involved in that. So he's very much part of it. He's always very, very excited to see the final lineup of programs for the year. He's unashamedly proud of what we do and compares them to other orchestras and says how much better they are than, look at this, look at what X is doing, look what Y is doing, look at this. So it's wonderful to see his response to the completed season, which takes a long time. You know, it's a sort of about 3 years in formation. So
yeah.
The point that we're at today, where we're looking at a completed season, is something that's been a process that's very, very gradually all unfolded, and as the various pieces of the puzzle fall into place, you see how it takes shape, and one element informs the next, and so on.
Yeah. Let's start with opening night, because that alone is such an interesting program.
Well, it's not opening night, but opening week.
I'm sorry, I should say opening week.
Yeah,
yeah, not quite the same thing as what we think of.
Not quite the same. We've decided we typically have a big gala event, which is one of our major fundraising activities for the year. At some stage in the year, it's often on the opening night. This year, for reasons which we will talk about in a minute, we've mm-hmm. moved it to the beginning of November. But I think the opening week is it's a very fresh program with lots of interconnections, about BSO history, current and future. But we wanted to invite, there's a marvelous young Dutch duo piano team, brothers Lucas and Arthur Jussen, and they're among the young piano stars of Europe at the moment. They're recording extensively. They've got terrific careers. And we thought, wouldn't it be fun to have a duo piano team to open our season? I had a look back, and it's probably back into the 80s sometime that we had actually had a piano duo in subscription. We've had it at Tanglewood more recently. But they're going to play the Poulenc Concerto, which is great fun. you know, it's Poulenc at his most witty, at his most sentimental, at his most romantic, at his most jazzy and provocative. So we thought that would be a terrific way to begin the program. We also wanted to feature our chorus in the opening week's program. Mm-hmm. And having the Poulenc as the opening work, it made us think about what else could fit nicely on that. And so we remembered the Poulenc Gloria as being a BSO commission. If it's 1953 or 54, that, it was certainly somewhere with Munch and with Adele Addison as the soprano soloist.
Okay.
It's a piece we haven't done for a few years. We did record it with Seiji back in the late 80s, early 90s, I'd say. So we thought it would be great to have the bookends of the two Poulenc works, the concerto for two pianos and then the Gloria.
Well, and those two sides of Poulenc, right?
And the two sides, yes. The sort of sacred,
the sacred and the playful. Profane,
And the profane, which is all about Poulenc's music. So in between, what to do? We have our chorus there and we have a couple of wonderful young pianists. Why not see whether one of them could do the Beethoven Choral Fantasy, which is always a great piece, an occasional piece. Calls for six solo singers, and so we're inviting six of the fellows from the vocal program of this summer's Tanglewood Music Center program to come and participate. So very nice connection between our summer activities and the subscription. And then continuing the great tradition of BSO commissions, thinking about the Poulenc's Gloria, we are featuring a new work by Eric Nathan, who wrote a really wonderful piece for us called The Space of a Door, which was a short but incredibly effective orchestra alone work, which all of our musicians very much enjoyed playing. It was great success. Eric is a fine composer who works in the and lives in the greater Boston area. And so we invited him to write a new work, which he's calling a concerto for orchestra. And Eric is a very regular attendee here at concerts at Symphony Hall, and I know has listened very, very carefully to the BSO over many seasons. And certainly this concerto for orchestra will reflect the personality of a lot of our principal players, I'm certain. So I think that it ends up being a very interesting program. So we have the Poulenc double to begin, then the Beethoven Choral Fantasy, then after intermission, the world premiere of Eric Nathan's Concerto for Orchestra, and finally the really glorious Gloria by Francis Poulenc.
Yeah, and that, I guess I wanted to ask about that specific program, and we won't go through every single program quite in such detail in this conversation, but it is one of those times when the opening week says some things, it looks to me, about what's going to come through the rest of the season. There are more commissions coming, and this isn't a commission. Eric Nathan's piece is not a commission that is, an overture that is like, put at the beginning of a program. That this is concerto for orchestra really denotes something substantial going on here, and the BSO has probably the greatest tradition of any American orchestra of new music creation. So that's why I wanted to sort of get into it, and I see now how you put the pieces together.
Well, it touches on our great tradition of performing French repertoire, mm-hmm. Our wonderful history of commissions, as you rightly pointed out. Mr. Beethoven's name is the name that stands above the proscenium of Symphony Hall. And so it really does speak to many dimensions of the orchestra and many of the themes that will inform the rest of the season, as you rightly point out, Brian.
Yeah, and the TFC with James Burton is just sounding magnificent these days, as evidenced in the Stabat Mater by Dvorak from a little bit earlier this season. And they'll be singing in four different programs. We won't go through all those right now, but again, a substantial part of the season is the TFC presence. And Andra's conducting that concert, of course, as the opening week.
Yes, I should mention, we're very happy to welcome back Nicole Cabell, who's...
Yes.
A wonderful American soprano. She's worked with us a few times, a glorious singer and a marvelous person. So it'll be a treat to have her back here.
And a voice for that soprano part in the Gloria. Oh,
well,
wow.
Well, that's right. And it's of a color quite akin to Adele Adamson, if any of you remember her from quite a few recordings. She's still with us, I believe. But she was a favorite of Munch and Bernstein and others, of Lucas Foss. And a wonderful artist. So I think Nicole's very much the next generation of that artistry.
Yeah. So any season of the BSO right now has as one of its pillars music by Shostakovich. There's a lot of it. You've gone through so much of it to such unbelievable success. Wide acclaim for these recordings, not just the, now we can say, three Grammys. That's certainly acknowledgement enough, but just reviews. People's responses to these recordings are extraordinary. And so the symphonies that you have during this season are Shostakovich's 12th and 2nd symphonies. What sides of Shostakovich do we see in those pieces? Oh, and also I should mention the Chamber Symphony, a sort of reworking of his 8th string quartet. What sides of Shostakovich are we going to kind of encounter in those pieces that maybe we haven't seen so far in the numerous ones that have been done over the last few years?
Well, interestingly, the BSO has never played the 12th nor the 2nd symphony before.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
The 2nd symphony we have scheduled this summer at Tanglewood as something of a tryout, because it's a rather unusual piece. It's relatively short. It's just over the 20-minute mark. It has a choral finale, which is a rather patriotic hymn to the October Revolution. And the early movements are in Shostakovich's rather sort of radical experimental style. It's a quirky piece, but I find ultimately very, very satisfying, and tells us a lot about the Shostakovich which is soon to come. That early experimental period, which probably finds its culmination in the magnificent 4th symphony. So we have that on the one hand, and then later in the season we're doing the 12th, which is called The Year 1917. Again, a very patriotic piece, but in a different style. It draws on a lot of themes from Shostakovich's 10th symphony. It's purely symphonic. It has no chorus in it. But again, picking up this theme of a celebration of critical points in Russian history. So it will be very interesting to hear the two quite late, mature piece versus a young, quite experimental Shostakovich. Added to that is the Chamber Symphony, which is the orchestration by Rudolf Barschai of the 8th Quartet, which is for string orchestra. Just by curiosity, this will be on the same disc as the 14th Symphony, which is for exactly the same forces. So we'll see quite a span of Shostakovich's style across the course of the year. We're on the home stretch of our Shostakovich symphony project. with next season with numbers 2 and 12 in the can, so to speak. That just leaves numbers 3 and 13, and then the great cycle will be completed. And it's been a long journey. As you say, the orchestra has grown in its intensity and familiarity with the style and the essence of Shostakovich's music, and it's been fascinating for all of us to be part of that trip.
Well, and that's where these particular symphonies, which are not, as you say, well, the first time here at the BSO, and not commonly performed really kind of by any orchestra, the second and the 12th. So for us to be able to experience those in the trajectory of this multi-year project, I think is just so valuable. You know, the contextual relationships of all the symphonies, may not be apparent exactly on first hearing to any particular person, but when you have this opportunity that the orchestra has given us over these number of years, and with Andras at the helm for all of them, it's just a great way to really sink into what it is that Shostakovich means. I want to put that in present tense, really. He's gone, but his music isn't, and what he means to expression, to history, to and even to the moment we're living in right now. I've found it just so relevant. So that's those particular pieces just will add, I think, immeasurably to the whole trajectory.
Programming the second Shostakovich is quite tricky to know what sort of context to put it in. Mm. And we struggled a lot with this program, but essentially it's sort of cast in a Russian-Baltic musical world. So the program begins with a brand new work by a Latvian composer who Andras has championed previously by the name of Artas Maskats. Interestingly, the piece is titled My River Runs to Thee, which is a homage to Emily Dickinson, so a local connection.
Yeah.
And then one of the most Russian of all pieces, the Violin Concerto by Tchaikovsky. And then a work and a composer I think who will be new to many, and she's a woman by the name of Galina Grigoryeva, and this will be a piece for chorus alone called On Leaving. Quite a mystical, spiritual piece. So we see many sort of dimensions of Soviet Baltic musical language and thought, and intersections of public and private, and the spiritual and the political. So I hope it's a program that gives rise to lots of discourse and opens up many new worlds for our subscribers and listeners.
I think absolutely. You mentioned a few minutes ago that your gala is moved to November, and there's a really good reason for that, which is that it comes in the same part of the season as this extraordinary week when your alliance with the Gewandhaus Orchestra takes its fullest form yet, which is that the Gewandhaus Orchestra will be right here in Boston for a number of concerts, including a couple with the Boston Symphony as a combined orchestra. So that's an enormous undertaking and really exciting to hear both these orchestras on their own and then together.
Well, this is certainly going to be one of the highlights of the season and will undoubtedly be one of the points of apex of our alliance with the Gewandhaus Orchestra, which next season will be in its third year and is operating on so many different levels. We've had some musicians here with us in Symphony Hall in the BSO this season. Last summer at Tanglewood, some of the young fellows from their training program came and joined the Tanglewood Music Center fellow. We've seen several, of course, co-commissions, and now this wonderful residency by the Gewandhaus Orchestra itself over a 10-day period. And they'll be doing two programs, very much of their repertoire on their own, a Sunday afternoon performance, which we're presenting jointly with our colleagues on the Celebrity Series, and then a concert on our own Tuesday evening subscription season. And then the grand finale, where we bring the two orchestras together for a program that I've got to tell you, Brian, we probably spent about 2 years talking about this program just to work out.
It's kind of a blockbuster.
Well, you know, when you think you obviously want to showcase a big orchestra, but one, you know, the obvious pieces are things like, when you say huge orchestra, you think of Gauralieder or the Mahler 8, but they're essentially not about the orchestra. They're about the soloists and the chorus, and of course their orchestral force, but we wanted something that would focus just on the orchestral forces themselves. So we've come up with a combination which we hope somehow realizes that goal. We begin with something of a rarity, and certainly a blockbuster, the Festive Prelude by Richard Strauss, which is has a very prominent organ solo, which will be played by Olivia Latry, who of course has been with us several times, marvelous French organist. And then on a much tinier scale, the Sinfonia Concertante by Haydn, which features bassoon, oboe, violin, and cello solos, along with classical-sized orchestra. And those four solos will be drawn from the two orchestras. So our own principal oboe and bassoon, John Farillo, Richard Svoboda, plus Frank Michael Erben and Christian Giger, the concertmaster and principal cellist of the Gewandhaus Orchestra. So it'll be wonderful to see the four colleagues up front in front of the combined forces. And then after intermission, a giant string section will play Schoenberg's Verklärte de Nacht, and then to conclude, the Poem of Ecstasy by Scriabin, which calls for everything imaginable.
And some incredibly virtuosic playing, it should be mentioned.
Absolutely. I mean,
the Poem of Ecstasy is quite an undertaking.
And we were sort of conscious of not leaning the program towards the tradition, specific tradition of either orchestra. You know, if we'd gone into doing something like Turangalila of Messiaen, that's very much a piece associated with the BSO. If we'd gone in a much stronger German direction, that would... So we've hoped to have found a sort of middle ground in all of this that might be a showcase for everyone. But certainly it will be a very, very exciting event, and our musicians are very excited to be working alongside their colleagues from the Gewandhaus, with whom they've established a lovely rapport over the first 3 years of the alliance.
Yeah, and if we could only imagine what Arnold Schoenberg would think about a string section like that taking on this piece, which has its string sextet version, but the orchestral version is that much more souped up, and now with two orchestras playing it, how much better could it get? I want to mention the number of guest conductors that you have coming in. We've talked about Andras being here for so many weeks, but a lot of different conductors are coming in. The thing that strikes me looking through the season is that only one of them was born before World War II, and that's Christoph von Dohnányi. And I'm so happy he's going to be back for the final week of the season. But this is a real generational shift in who's leading orchestras internationally, and now, yes, who's coming to Symphony Hall. And I guess my question for you, if I can just get to a specific point, is you know a lot of those guys who came from the pre-World War II generation. And they've been such valuable contributors and collaborators with the BSO over decades. What do you see in that generation that now comes after them that's really valuable? What are they bringing that's distinct from that earlier generation? And I'm talking about the conductors like, say, Susanna Malki, who's, I think, 50 years old, and Alain Altinoglu, who's in his 40s. And, you know, we have some older gentlemen as well, like Christian Zacharias, who I'm thrilled to be back, and Andras Schiff will be here. But tell me about the post-World War II conductor generation, if that's not too broad a question.
That's a very interesting question, and I don't want to give an answer that's going to contradict myself, but I think the particular selection of conductors we have coming with us, which are all of a similar generation, as you point out, bring both a sense of internationalism plus repertoire specialties. And so when you look at the group of guest conductors we have next season, they are all conductors who are operating right throughout the world, many different orchestras. They have big careers in Europe, in Asia, in America. That wasn't always the case of the pre-World War II generation.
Oh, okay,
and
yeah.
And I think that is a major difference in the sort of general makeup of the current crop of conductors.
Those conductors like Mazur or that generation would be centered in specific places more.
That's exactly right. Yeah. You know, Christoph was, although he did come and had some of his training in America, was very much based in Germany and Europe, as was Mazur. He was in the former East Germany for a very long time. Raphael Frubeck de Burgos operated in sort of Eastern Europe for a good part of his career. So they all had, you know, a very, very clear basis of their musical training and focus, whereas the current generation is much more eclectic, much more international in perspective. So anyway, there is that. But we have also specifically asked some conductors to come who will bring a real specialty in certain areas of the repertoire. Alain Altinoglu, for instance, is a French conductor who conducts marvelously the French repertoire, and he is bringing Debussy and Saint-Saëns and Poulenc with him. Hannu Lintu is bringing Scandinavian repertoire. Susanna Malki, who's so marvelous in new music, is doing the American premiere of a new work by a Swiss composer, Dieter Amann. So we've invited conductors who have a real strength in particular areas that in many ways complement Andras's great strengths, which are he's incredibly versatile, but you know, he can't do everything. So we've looked for that mix. You know, sadly, a lot of the senior generation are no longer with us. You know, in the last few years, when you think we've lost most recently, very sadly, André Previn, Mazur, Frubeck de Burgos, Colin Davis. There are some that are still active, of course, like we had Maestro Blomstedt only a matter of weeks ago.
Yes, amazingly.
Marvelous concerts at the end of last season with Bernard Haitink, but he's very gradually slowing down, and one hopes but wonders whether we'll ever see him back here in Boston. So it's quite a significant generational shift that we see happening, at least in relation to those guests with whom we've had a long and deep relationship.
Yeah. A huge generational span encompasses the people from whom you've commissioned new music. And I think that's really exciting. I think from Betsy Jolas, who's 92 years old, to as you mentioned before, Eric Nathan in his 30s. I think this is a really exciting thing as well. Not just the number of commissions that you have, but also the span of creative voices.
Yes, and it's a very eclectic mix, and I'm quite proud of that, I must say. You know, over the years there have been certain periods where we've focused on a particular school or tradition. With Andres's tenure, he has brought some new voices into the repertory, and I think that's all reflected very much in the selection of new pieces that we have for next year. You mentioned Eric's piece and Betsy Jolas, but we also have a work by Shixin Shiyun Lee, who's a wonderful Taiwanese-American composer. Dieter Amann, a marvelous Swiss composer who's probably a new name to many of us. Helen Grime, a young Scottish composer who was a fellow at Tanglewood. She's now having a terrific career. Ardis Muscats, again, will be new to many, but a composer with a huge catalogue, wonderful career, but just hasn't gained the prominence here in the States that he has elsewhere. So we hope that this big voyage of discovery will be one that will excite our listeners and certainly open up new vistas to the orchestra and to many of the listeners on radio.
I have to admit that I haven't run the metrics here, but tell me about the number of commissions and premieres that the BSO is doing this season compared to most BSO seasons.
It's probably several more than usual. We typically we have three or four commissions per season. This season, I think there are seven in the main season, and then we have a new work by Michael Gandolfi for the Boston Symphony Chamber Players. We have a few of our older commissions, which I'm pleased coming back. I mentioned the Poulenc Gloria, but also the Walton Cello Concerto, the Bartok Concerto for Orchestra, which needs no advocacy whatsoever. But we need just to remember that it's something that we brought into being all those years ago. So I think it's a very interesting mix, and I hope it's one that excites all of our listeners and subscribers.
Yeah. Listeners and subscribers, you mentioned before your dialogue with Andres about programming and about various pieces and programs that come together with guest conductors, as well as, of course, his own programs. But I want to ask about the role of listeners and audiences and how they might inform your decisions and your directions and your ideas and what we hear. I mean, I'm just saying, you know, the headlines you see, there's the perennial orchestral audiences aging headline. I don't put too much stock in that because orchestral audiences have been aging for the last 120 years, and we still have great audiences. But audience habits, I think, really have changed in terms of their ways of looking at their ticket buying options and what they want to get when they come to the hall. How do those different habits and demographics inform your own planning and ideas?
Just to pick up on one point, I think anyone who's been to Symphony Hall in the last 12 months, 18 months, will have noticed a marked change in the demographic of the audience. It's now notably, I think, a much younger audience than it has been. And this is the end point of a lot of hard work, I must say, particularly in our marketing team, with some generous supporters who've helped keep down ticket prices for some of our younger attendees. So there has been a marked shift, I think, and it's great. The energy, you come on a Saturday night or for the Friday casual concerts, the energy, the youthful energy in the hall is really palpable. It's great.
Yeah, it is.
We know that audiences today like to have greater choices and keep their options open until much closer to an event. So the old days of subscribing to 24 programs for the whole year and that being absolutely sacrosanct is not quite as strong as it used to be. And we find that audiences and subscribers want to have the flexibility of being able to put together their own selection of programs, or often wait until the last minute to decide whether they're going to come to a BSO concert or go and see something at the ART or go to a movie or go to a jazz performance. So we are in a competitive market in that sense, and so it's not so much my concern but more of my colleagues in the marketing and press team that they have to keep all of the balls in the air, so to speak, until the last minute, and then hope that we can just give the right impetus for someone to decide they're going to come to the BSO on that particular night. There are plenty of ways in which we get feedback about the programs. I attend every program, of course, sometimes two or three times. For me, sitting in the hall, the audience response is a very important immediate barometer and sense of feedback. We have more formal mechanisms through audience research. We also find that our patrons are not reluctant to give us their comments. They write in. They've got plenty of opinions. They like to share them. We are blessed to have an incredibly informed audience here in Boston, and one with a very high listening capacity and well-informed listeners. And so the comments that we get back are always very, very useful. So all of that comes to inform, you know, the final selection. Of course, there are pure practicalities. Very, very important dimension of all of this is just the workload for our musicians throughout the course of the year, making sure that the balance of styles and of sequence of programs is one that, you know, maintains a good flow and a good energy. So all of those things come together. There's no sort of single factor.
And just to put a fine point on that, sometimes if, I mean, this is an exaggeration, but if you programmed a bunch of Bruckner and, say, Schubert in a number of weeks, you'd have a lot of repetitive stress injury. And, I mean, that's not even a joke. That's literally something to consider as you're programming things.
Absolutely. And also, if we're going to do a new work, which will be completely unfamiliar, we want to be able to devote enough time to properly prepare it. So it makes sense to have that on a program where there's something that is already familiar to the orchestra, that they can be confident that they sort of at least know, if they don't know the particular approach of a conductor, they know the work, they know what the technical challenges are, and they can be ready in advance of the first rehearsal for that. So it's a matter of balance on all dimensions of the program.
Well, after last season's Wagner concert with Jonas Kaufmann, you decided to follow that up with another one. What better could there be? Because Jonas is an amazing singer. And so tell me about what went into the decision to return to that model of a Wagner opera, an act from a Wagner opera here in the hall with Jonas Kaufmann.
Well, it took us several years to persuade Jonas to take on Act Two of Tristan because, you know, it's one of the sort of Everests of the tenor's repertoire.
Yeah.
In that Fach as much as anything. He had agreed to take on Act Two of Tristan. Loved it so much that immediately he said he wanted to do Act Three, and so we seized the moment and got it as soon into our schedule as we could, which was two seasons later. And here we have Act Three with Jonas as Tristan, the American soprano Emily McGee, who's perhaps better known in Europe than she is here, but a wonderful singer in taking the role of Isolde, and then Michel de Jong, et cetera, et cetera. So it's like a progressive rollout of Tristan and Isolde. I can't predict whether we'll be doing the whole thing or not at any one time, but I suspect it's in the not too distant future for Jonas on the stage at least, and we're thrilled that we've had the opportunity to hear him as he embarks on this this great work.
Well, and he actually told us when he was here that this would be kind of like his build-up to taking on that role on stage. And it is just an incredible voice. I mean, Jonas, from that time that he came for Andres' first concert, I mean, there's just something that's so magnetic about his voice. So what better way to feature him than in Act Three of Tristan? There's a very unusual concert that you have in this coming season with Yuri Kane. And tell us a little bit about Yuri Kane, where he's coming from, and how this particular program was put together.
Somewhat as a follow-up to the program that we had recently here in Symphony Hall with Thomas Wilkins, we wanted next season to continue that exploration of the great tradition of African-American composers. And with that in mind, we invited the conductor André Raphael to put together, devise a program. André had been with us once before conducting some youth concerts. He's had a great career. He was the assistant conductor in Philadelphia, and he was someone that we were planning and looking forward to working with. So we invited, and he wanted to do a program which combined a couple of seminal older works by African-American composers, the Symphony No. 1 by William Grant Still and the piece by Samuel Coleridge Taylor, alongside a work which celebrated an important figure in African-American political and social history. And this is a very important 19th century figure based in Philadelphia named Octavius Cato, who was a social activist, an educator, a baseball player, an extremely important figure in just galvanizing the whole voting rights for African Americans. And this piece, The Passion of Octavius Cato, was created on commission from the Philadelphia Orchestra about 4 years ago by the composer Uri Caine. And it tells not only of the life and work of Octavius Cato, but does so through a celebration of many of the genres and musical styles associated with the African-American tradition. It was a tremendous success on its premiere in Philadelphia, and it's going to be, I think, the centerpiece for a lot of work that we'll be doing with other organizations around the Boston area who are focused on this aspect of history. It calls for a gospel chorus, and we will be forming a special chorus just for this program. So we're really looking forward to this opportunity to inviting many, many new partners into Symphony Hall in celebration of this great tradition.
That is one of the things I love most about orchestras and their place in a civic context, that there are these moments when we're all a little bit more illuminated, not just because the music is great, but because of the meanings and the stories behind the music. And so what a terrific set of music. William Grant Still probably doesn't get heard enough, and so wonderful to hear his music along with Uri Caine and Samuel Coleridge Taylor. So terrific program in March of the 1920 season. You've just extended the relationship with Thomas Addis as VSO artistic partner, and for very good reason, because, boy, there's been some dynamite events, music, making, all kinds of things that have happened since he became artistic partner, and even before that. So Tom's got such an amazing way of putting together programs because he himself, he just sees so much relationship that I think... I'll use the term in an exaggerated way, but mere mortals don't actually find those connections the same way he does. When he's coming, do you just sort of say, Tom, what do you want to do? And let him take it from there?
Well, not quite.
We talk
it through. But just back on the subject of the extension, you know, we sort of felt like we'd barely got started with Tom, especially at Tanglewood, where last summer he directed, I think, one of the most interesting festivals of contemporary music that we'd had in a long time, and did wonderful work with our students there. So we felt that we needed another couple of years to follow through on all of this wonderful energy that he's brought to us. But Tom always has a lot of great ideas. He's been wanting to perform Stravinsky's Persephone with us for some time, and we thought that this would be the opportunity with the Tanglewood Festival Chorus in a wonderful state of renewal, and of course our new Boston Symphony Children's Choir. This would be a great chance to showcase those. So it was a great choice, and it's a marvelous piece. We've done it a couple of times before, and we're combining this with Stravinsky's Pulcinella and a beautiful piece of Tom called L'Heure Retrouvée, which is for cello and orchestra, which will be performed by Stephen Isserles, for whom it was composed. So there will be an added authenticity about that work too. So I think a very elegant program, and we're looking forward to another couple of seasons of Tom's incredible talent here in Boston with us.
Well, his music is just so enlivening. And so I think when the piano concerto was just premiered here, the thing that I heard most from people who were hearing it is that it is so Tom. I mean, Kirill Gerstein said that about the piece. It is so Tom. There's such a distinctive individual voice that he has. And so that when you combine that with his programming knowledge and programming proclivities, I'll put it that way, he just has so many interesting ways of contextualizing music. So it's going to be a terrific part of the season. Tony Fogg, I love our conversations about these things. Thanks for taking some time to talk with me about all of this today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Brian.